Well, hey there. Welcome to The Real Podcast. We share the stories and insights of real people that challenge your mind and inspire you to grow. For more information and resources, check out our website at CochraneAlliance.com/real. So, let's get real.
All right, here we go. Last summer, my family and I, the summer of 2018, my family and I had a real privilege of being able to take some time off of work, and we spent 8 weeks in about 4 different countries in Southeast Asia, visiting friends, enjoying some time off, enjoying great food, and connecting with different people who we've known in the past. And one of the opportunities we had is to stay at for an extended time in one of those particular countries, and I was able to see firsthand a human situation that is going on in the world that I'd only read in the newspaper, but I got to see with my own eyes and introduce my own kids to the issue, and that is the Rohingya refugee crisis. I don't know, those who are listening today, your familiarity with what's going on in the country of Myanmar and also Bangladesh, where many of these people have fled. But the Rohingya are an ethnic Muslim minority. There are maybe 3.5 million of them dispersed worldwide. And they have, because they are a Muslim minority in a Buddhist majority country in Myanmar, they have faced persecution and oppression for many years. But the situation really exploded in August 2017 when a number of factors came together where the military began to push these people out, and hundreds of thousands of them followed already some previous exits, primarily into Bangladesh, but many Rohingya have fled to other countries in Southeast Asia. And it is my privilege today to welcome a longtime friend into the Real studio, Bob Thorne. Bob, welcome to Real.
Thanks, Jason. It's great to be here.
Bob and I go back, it's hard to believe, a few of my guests here, I keep doing this, but we go back more than 20 years. Yeah. When I was a rookie youth pastor, there was an established set of experienced youth veterans in the Calgary area, of which Bob was one, and he helped me cut my teeth in my youth ministry, and we did a number of events together. And over the years, we've grown, and as we went into leading churches and supported one another in our ministries and support groups. And it's been a privilege to follow Bob as he's been called to lead an international church in Southeast Asia, and has, as we're going to hear a little bit today, encountered Rohingya people in his context. So, Bob, before we get into that, who are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, as you said, we were in youth ministry together. I was a youth pastor for 18 years, and then I was able to plant a church in North Calgary. And then our family was invited to go to Southeast Asia, where, as you said, I pastor an international church. And my wife and I have 3 children and 4 grandchildren. And so it's just great to be here. I'm passionate about the Rohingya people, and excited to be able to share that with your listeners.
Cool. So I know you initially didn't go to your city to work with Rohingya. When you went more than 10 years ago now, what were the primary jobs or activities you thought you were going to be doing when you moved?
Well, I went there to pastor an international church, and it was a church that we didn't know it until we got there. That was in a little bit of a crisis. And so for our first 3 years there, I pastored a church and helped to lead the church through some difficult issues that we were facing. And in year 4, I felt like the church was finally at a place of health. And that's when I began to take a look around and see in the setting where I was, what other things can I be involved in, and can our church be involved in as well?
Okay. So tell us about those first, I don't know if you can remember the first encounter with a Rohingya person, but tell us about those first Rohingya encounters. How did it happen?
Well, I had begun to notice in our city a number of migrant workers. They were hidden. And there was one area of our city where there was a shanty town of, I don't know, I can't remember exactly, but between 2,500 and 3,500 migrant workers, and they just lived in these little shacks. Mm. And every Sunday night, I would just go and I would walk in the shanty town, and I would try and find people who could speak English. And it was there that I began to meet some of these people. And then I also went with another friend, a colleague, into some of the construction sites. And we met a young man by the name of Muhib. Hmm. And Muhib became, still is a great friend today, but he became the first Rohingya who got involved in what we started as a learning center in our city.
That's maybe a great launching off point. Can you tell Muhib's story of coming to the country where you are? And maybe as you're doing that, explain, give us a little bit. I've tried to set the context for what's happening in Myanmar, Bangladesh. But if you could use Muhib or maybe another one of your friend's stories to tell us what's going on and why these people are in your country and not in their home state and Rakhine state in Myanmar.
Yeah, life was so difficult for them in Rakhine state that many, many people were surrendering themselves to human traffickers and to make it to another country with hopes of a better life. So Muhib got on a boat when he was, I believe, 18 years old and made his way to our country. It was a long, circuitous route. They ran into problems with navies, foreign navies in Southeast Asia, and they ended up on an island in India for some time, and finally made it to our country. And he suffered terribly. They were so hungry on this island that they were eating leaves. They began to drink seawater. He was so desperate at one point, he drank the diesel fuel that he found on the boat that he was on.
I see.
And so he made his way to our country and became a very, pardon me, became a very good friend of mine. Hmm. You know, he's 24 years old. He speaks 8 different languages, so he is a bright young man, but his life was just so difficult. His father died when he was 2 years old, and he wanted to be able to help support his family back in Myanmar. So he found a job, he began working and sending money back, and his brother was able to build a house for his family and for his mother. And that gave Muhib great, great pride.
Gave him dignity.
Yes, that's right.
So now that would have been in the early 2010s.
Yes.
So we've heard on the radio and on the TV that things have changed for the much worse in Rakhine State. Does their house still exist? And tell us about what's happened for a lot of families like Muhib's who maybe aren't there anymore.
Yeah, in August, I believe it was August 24th, 2017, the Burmese army went into Rakhine State and began forcing people out. They were killing, they were raping, they were pushing everybody out, and they pushed out 1 million Rohingya who had to cross the Naaf River into Bangladesh in the region of Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. And they have refugee camps there now. And, you know, there's 1 million people living in refugee camps. So you mentioned about Muhib's family's home. You know, Muhib took great pride that he worked hard, sent the money to his family to build the house, but that house has now been destroyed. Mm. It's gone. And that breaks Muhib's heart. you know, he had worked, given his life for 4 or 5 years of working, sending all the money back so that his family could have a home.
Hmm. I had the privilege of talking with another one of your main translators, Salim, and he talked to us extensively about the human traffickers and how the system works on the initial price of what it's they're told they can go to another country, but how that changes in transit. Can you tell us maybe the story of him or someone else how it actually works?
Well, I'll tell you my very first experience. It was on January 1st. Oh boy, I don't remember exactly what year, but around 2013. And it was New Year's Day, and I was sitting at my home with my wife, and we had friends visiting from another country. And my phone rang, and it was a young man named Alom. And he said, "Mr. Bob," that's what they call me, mm-hmm. "Mr. Bob, can you come and see me?" So I went to a local market, and I met him. And he had written out in his best attempt at English what was happening. And what I found out is that his wife and 2 young children had left Rakhine State without him knowing it. Mm. He had come to find a job, and he was doing well. But his wife, life was so difficult for her there and their 2 young sons that they surrendered themselves to human traffickers. They were stuck at another country that was a holding area for all those that were trafficked. And they were told that they need to pay a ransom. So I went there, and they put me on the phone with the human traffickers, and I tried to negotiate a lower price because Alom just didn't have the money that he could pay the ransom. And so I only have a theological education. Nobody
not only Bob, that's what you have.
Nobody trained me to
talk
to human traffickers and things like that. And so I did my best, and they laughed at me, hung up the phone, and I would go each week to pray with Alom that his family would be released. Many of them would ask me for money, but I couldn't begin to help one person financially because then word gets out and I become the one to give. So I said, "I can't give you money, but I can come and I can pray with you." And so I went every week, and I still remember the day he came about 4 months later. He came running up to me and said, "I just got word that my wife and 2 boys are going to be released. Can you drive me up to the border to pick up my wife and my 2 boys? So that Saturday morning, I went and picked Alom up, and we drove up to another city north of us, about a 2-hour drive, and we went into a grocery parking lot, and we waited for a phone call. And
it's like a movie.
Yeah, it really is. And then a taxi came in, and Alom's wife and 2 boys get out of the taxi, and we go and meet them. And we immediately put them in my vehicle and begin to drive back home. Mm. She was so traumatized. She had witnessed so much. As soon as the car started, she just started throwing up in the back seat. We had come equipped for such a case, but she was so sick. And so on the way home, I phoned a doctor from our church who I knew was sympathetic to what we were doing, and we got her in to get treatment. And so that family was reunited, thankfully. He was a student for quite some time, but the community that we work with, the Rohingya community in our country, is very transient. They go wherever they can find work. Mm. And so he has since moved to another city.
Okay.
Yeah.
So back us up, because we talked about you meeting these people. as you began to meet primarily men in your area, you saw an opportunity to serve them. So what developed that was more structured than just kind of random meeting?
No, that's a good question. We started a learning center where we would teach English. We had ESL teaching, which I had never been trained in, didn't really know what we were doing, but we kind of learned as we went along. And we also did Bible storying. We have on our phones 21 Bible stories that have been translated into their language, and we talked a lot with them about Isa al-Masi, Jesus Christ, and who he is, and how valuable the Rohingya are to Jesus. And so we started that. And then I still can't remember how I got invited to a meeting with the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Hmm. And I was invited to a meeting and became a partner with them. And I began to interview all of these young men that were coming to help them get their refugee designation. Hmm. The country we live in, they don't recognize refugees, and so life is very difficult for the Rohingya in the country in which I live as well.
Okay, so maybe that's a good place to pick it up. Most of us would think, okay, if you are in your home country, your women are getting raped, your houses are being burnt, you have no rights, that getting into another country in Southeast Asia where you can at least work and be in relative peace, that your problems are solved. Why isn't that the case in your particular country for these people? Because they're out of the heat from the Burmese army.
Right. Well, that's the difficult thing, because the Rohingya, they're a stateless people. According to the UN, 2 years ago, I don't know if it's still the case, but they're the most persecuted people group in the world. Mm. And nobody wants them. Mm. They're poor, most highly illiterate. Their language is not a written language; it's all oral, and so they are not wanted anywhere. And so they try to go to other countries, and because they're a Muslim people group, they try and go to Muslim countries, and they hope that the Muslim people there will accept them because they're Muslim brothers and sisters, but they have found that that's not the case because they are such a poor people group and
they have nothing to offer.
That's right, nothing to offer. So they are just really there's nobody who really wants them, and so we talk a lot with the guys we work with about hope, because many of them say, well, life is hopeless. Life is hopeless. So what is the point? We thought that we would come to this country or to that country and be received and we would have a better life. But life is just as difficult and just as painful here as it was back in Rakhine State.
I see. Can you tell me some of the stories that have affected me? I remember when I was in your city, I love cycling, and on one of the main roads, there was a big giant cycling store that I was all enamored with, and went in and looked at the bikes, and they were even more expensive than they are in Canada. And so took pictures there and was shopping around. And then I realized that around the corner was one of the migrant camps.
That's
like
right.
Literally 100 or 200 meters from this luxury store that represented all that I love about being a rich Westerner. And I know that many, as you've said, many of the Rohingya work in the construction industry, but they're not allowed to legally work there, which means they're taken advantage of by their bosses, and then they are hunted down at certain times by the local police. And you've told me one or two stories about the construction workers and raids that go on. I just wonder if you have a story that you could share with those who are listening about what it's like to be earning money, but also not to be in fear in some ways. Tell me about maybe what a couple of your guys have experienced in their work sites.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned Muhib, who was the first student we had at our learning center, And I remember many nights, because the raids in this country usually happened at certain times of the year. Mm. And so the guys, the Rohingya guys would go up into the hills, mm. because the police generally wouldn't go up there, or the immigration wouldn't go up there. So they would go up and they would sleep with tarpaulin covering, but they obviously you can't sleep, particularly in rainy season, mm-hmm. when the raids were happening and the rains come down, and so they just lived in constant fear. Mm. Leaving their work sites, they're afraid. Staying in their work sites, they're afraid. Mm. They're all highly traumatized. All of the people that I work with are victims of human trafficking. Mm. They've all either voluntarily surrendered themselves to human traffickers or been made by family members to go with the human traffickers in order to go to another country to work, to send money back to their families.
Okay. So I know that now this has also evolved, and that not only have you developed relationships with the men primarily in your city, but also as a way of serving them, reached out to their families, most of whom now are in refugee camps in Bangladesh. So
that's right.
How did that happen? And tell us what it was like going to Cox's Bazaar and seeing now some of these people who are displaced.
Yeah. When that happened in August of 2017, I was sitting with a group of our students one night. Not many came because they were so traumatized. They didn't know where their families were. And I remember sitting around a table with a group of guys, and right in the middle of our conversation, his phone rang. His name was Haras, and it was his dad phoning. He was in the mountains somewhere in Myanmar trying to get to cross the Naf River into Bangladesh. And just in my own times of prayer, I thought, these guys that I'm working with, when they left their country, they knew they would probably never see their families mm-hmm. again. And now their families have been pushed out of their homeland and are now in refugee camps. And I thought it would be an amazing thing if I could go and meet the families of my students. So what I would do is I would take a photo of myself with the student. I would get the student's name, the student's father's name, and a phone number that they could be reached at and what camp they were in. And then I went, I found a good friend in Bangladesh who would serve as a translator for me. And we would go and we would go to the camps, just get on the phone, and we would track down these families. And I've lost track, but probably made connections with 80 or 90 families of the students from our country and visited with their families who were in the refugee camps. And I'll tell you, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Mm. Just being able to be that human connection. Mm. You know, I went for the very first time just before Christmas 2017, and the whole idea of the incarnation, about Jesus coming, God coming in the flesh, and it just took on new meaning for me because I was able to be flesh, my students, be a human representative to their families in the camps. And over again, I had fathers saying to me, I release my son into your care.
Mm. Wow.
You know, just the, and, you know, one story in particular just really struck me. Another young man who he's just this little guy, probably 25 or 26 years old.
Yep.
But he and his father had a big argument because he wanted to come to our country, and his father did not want him to go. He said, no, you stay here. Your family is in Rakhine State. But his son went anyways mm. without telling his father. And I went, and I met with the father, and he just wept as I showed the picture of his son. And it was just a very emotional time as he told me the story and how thankful he was to me and to those who are working, helping the Rohingya in our country, to just saying thank you for loving them. Thank you for caring for our sons. So being able to be that human connection between victims of human trafficking in our country who can't leave, they're stuck there.
Yep.
And I have a passport. I have the freedom to go. And so I went, and then I would connect with their families. There, it was just powerful time and time again to be able to just be that amazing connection. For me, the one of the most amazing God stories for me as I went into the camps is on my phone I have the pictures of 200 or 300 Rohingya guys who have come to our classes.
Yes.
And I would just be standing at the side of the road and there would be a big crowd. There's a lot of boredom in the refugee camps. There's nothing for them to do. And so they find out that a teacher is there from this certain country and they would gather around me and they would scroll through my phone looking at the picture, seeing if it was their brother or son or uncle. And oftentimes, no. But one day this young man came up to me and said, My son is in your city, my brother is in your city. And he scrolled through my phone, and he stopped and he said, This is my brother. This is Mustafa. You must come and visit my family today. Mm. So my translator and I hopped on his motorcycle, and we followed the brother to the camp that he was in, and we went in to this home, and I showed the picture of Mustafa to his mother, and she just wept like nothing I've ever seen or experienced before. It was so moving. She broke all of, and I broke all the cultural barriers, because she just threw her arms around me and just buried her face in my chest and just wept tears and sorrow that I don't think I had ever seen or experienced before. And it was for a good 5 minutes. And finally, she composed herself, and she backed up from me a couple of steps, and she removed her headscarf from her neck and revealed that there was a huge tumor growing on her throat. And she said through the translator, "I'm going to die soon. And I didn't think I would ever see my son again. But because you're here and you love my son, I feel like I'm seeing my son." And just to be able to lay hands on her and pray for her in Jesus' name and pray that God would do a work in their family, just a privilege that has changed my life. Yeah.
So tell us about that. What's different about post-Rohingya Bob Thorne than pre-Rohingya yeah. Bob Thorne?
Yeah. You know, I've always prayed. I shouldn't say always. I think there was a time early on in my pastoral ministry in Canada where I wasn't a terribly compassionate man. And I had been praying that God would give me a heart of compassion. You know, and as you look at the scriptures, as you look through the gospel, you see Jesus, how he treated the poor and the marginalized and how he loved them and how he was broken with compassion for them on numerous occasions. And so my heart has been tenderized in a way that I never thought possible in terms of my love for the broken of this world. And so I'm a totally different man. How I look at the poor, how I serve alongside the poor, how I love them and care for them. I know I can't meet all of their needs.
Sure.
I know that I only see them for maybe 2 hours a week. They work all the time. They have very little free time. But what free time they have, they often give to me and mm-hmm. to our classes, and because they know that we love them. Hmm. One of the questions that has really been an important one for me, and it's been asked by different people on different occasions, all Rohingya, and they say to me, why is it the Jesus followers who are helping us and not our Muslim brothers? And they really struggle with that. They don't understand it, because I don't make any apologies that I'm a follower of Jesus. And we talk about the truth of who Jesus is unashamedly, and they are open and they are responsive and they love to interact with who Jesus is. And so they know that they are loved. I was sitting around with a group of people. It's happened twice, once in the class and once in one of the refugee camps in Bangladesh. And they asked me, why would you leave Canada, where many of our people would love to go to another country and then to go into the refugee camps? Why would you do that for our people? And what a great opportunity to tell them about Jesus and Jesus' love for them as a people. And Jesus loves the Rohingya. How can I not love the Rohingya? Right. And so just to be able to speak to them of the love of Christ, and we haven't seen a huge turning to the Lord. We have seen two young men give their lives to Christ. One of them is very, very committed to telling people about Jesus, and at great risk to himself. And every day, I just today received more messages from him that he has, I've talked with 10 more families. Wow. I'm meeting with two more families tomorrow. And so it's exciting to see this one young man who has given his life to Christ, and now he is beginning to tell those same stories that we've walked with him through.
Yep.
He's now telling them to his own countrymen.
Wow.
It's awesome.
Wow, that's incredible. Maybe a follow-up from what's changed in you. I get you and your wife send weekly updates, and it could be my perception, but in my perception, the prayer requests, is particularly this past year, it seems that your frustration at politics or world order or injustice has heightened significantly. So I don't know. Have you know? Is that just me? And as you think about, you know, the small little way, but the incredible global scale of the injustice that these people are facing, what's changing about the way you think about the world, or how you pray, or the craziness of the human situation?
Yeah, I read a fantastic book, I don't know, about 3 years ago by Tim Keller called Generous Justice. Highly recommend it. It just has challenged my own view on what justice is. And so I would say that there has been a lot of anger, some of it righteous anger, some of it not so righteous, because it just, there are times when I'm just angry when I see people who have power and authority, how they treat the poor and the marginalized, and how they push them down even further and try and take advantage of them and extort money from them and treat them with no dignity, no respect. And I've always been a believer that every human being, we all bear the thumbprint of God. We are valued. So I don't know if I become more angry, but I think that just what I feel, the hopelessness for that these people feel as I talk with them and as I hear their stories, there is just a growing hopelessness amongst this people saying, what are we going to do? I have nothing to look forward to. And so, sadly, some of them are being radicalized because they are ripe for the picking, because they don't see any way out. They hope for resettlement to a third country, a more developed country, but less than 1% of all the refugees in the world will be resettled in any one year. And so the chances of that happening are very, very slim. So I guess I just am, I'm overwhelmed by the need. And I think, what can be done? Why isn't the world more sensitized to this? I'm still stunned when I come back to Canada and how many people still have never heard of the Rohingya, even though it's been big news, particularly in late 2017. But I know the news cycles move on to the new stories, but these are people I come into contact with on almost a daily basis where I live, and I love them, and I care for them, and I want to see many of them confess Jesus. I want to see many of them live lives of purpose, and that they are filled again with hope that they have been without for many years now.
Do you think the situation will change in Bangladesh or Myanmar?
Boy, it apart from a miracle, I don't see it. From everything that I read, there is no movement. The military is still in charge in Myanmar, and they've said they're open to receiving Rohingya back, but it basically would be like putting them in a concentration camp with no freedom of movement, and not a good situation. The Rohingya don't want to go back unless they are granted full citizenship and the rights of citizenship.
Happen.
But that is not going to happen with the current climate. And so the only hope many of them have is that there are some countries that will open the doors to them. But I know some of the countries in Southeast Asia, they're afraid to give the Rohingya the right to work. They're afraid to give them some of the benefits, because it will just open the floodgates again, and more will start leaving the refugee camps and going to other countries in Southeast Asia.
So it's you know that the West, for various reasons, there seemed to be a bit of a bump for Syrian refugees a couple years ago in Canada, but in general, the trend in Europe and North America is not to open the doors wider, it's to close the door. How does that make you feel?
Well, it saddens me because particularly within the church, when I hear people say, well, no, we need to close the doors, you know, we have too many people from this country or this country.
From this background.
Yeah, from this background. And I understand the economics of it, that you know, a country like Canada can't receive all of these refugees. There is an economic cost to it, and I understand that piece. But I think that all of us could do a little bit more to change things for this small group of people or that group of people, you know, for a few families, that it would just change their lives.
Or stop posting stupid stuff on Facebook.
Yeah, that would be a good start. That would be a really good start.
So follow that up. The Real Podcast audience is worldwide, Bob. Worldwide.
Okay.
But most of us probably are Canadians. What would you say to a Canadian person listening? What can we do to help the situation?
Well, I think be informed, because I know we live in a instant world and we can have information overload, but for me, you know, because God has given me a real heart for this particular people group, I want everybody to know about them and to see what their plight is in the world. Mm. And to be able to, maybe we can help a few families through the Government of Canada has a sponsorship program. Mm-hmm. And I know many churches have helped Syrian refugees and refugees from other countries. Mm-hmm. I know that there were just from one particular country in Southeast Asia, there was just 9 families and one single young man who happened to be one of our students who was just resettled to Kitchener-Waterloo.
Okay.
And so it is happening one person at a time, but it gives hope, I think, for these people. I think so many of them have been disappointed by hope. Mm. They came to our country and other countries with a hope for a better life, and it just has not panned out, and they've just been disappointed time and time and time again.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you and your team?
Well, we're just asking the Lord right now, what are some ways that we can be more effective in helping this people group, not just survive, but to thrive in the place where they are now. And so we're looking at a couple of different initiatives that I can't say because we don't know for sure, but we are looking at a couple of very specific things in our country. We have new teammates who have just joined us in the last year. We'll have another person joining us in the end of September. And so we're just excited about what God has for us in the next steps. We would love to see many of these people in a situation where they can have dignity and they can feel that they have value. Mm. And ultimately, we would love to see the church established amongst that people group, but that is a work of the Spirit of God, and,
sure.
and we want to join Him in what He's doing. We want to meet the needs that we can meet of those that we come into contact with on an almost daily basis.
Mm, cool. Bob, thanks for giving us a bit of perspective on something that the majority of us will never even catch a glimpse of. It's a privilege to have seen it with my own eyes and expose my kids to a little bit of the work that you are doing. And although I don't know if I'm anybody's little brother, but your younger brother, it's a great deal of pride to be able to be here and know the work that you're contributing and investing in those people. And also following in the footsteps of Jesus, who also left his country and comfort for our sake and hung out with us who are quite impoverished and carry on. And I, as a person here in Cochrane, it's been neat to see some of our community's awareness grow for Rohingya people, and we don't know how that will look and expand in the future, but it's a privilege even to hear more, and pass my greetings to those friends who know me a tiny bit in your city.
I will. Thanks. Great. I love the opportunities to speak about these people. I love them dearly, and so thanks for giving me this platform to tell some more people about who they are.
Our privilege.
Thanks for listening to The Real Podcast. For more information on this episode and others, check out our website at CochraneAlliance.com/real. Until next time, keep it real.